This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to a reshuffle special of The View from 22, The Spectator's podcast. I'm Fraser Nelson, editor of The Spectator, and joining me now are Isabel Hardman, our assistant editor, and James Forsyth, our political editor. Thanks for coming, both. And let's take the biggest surprise we've had today, the departure of Michael Gove from education to become chief whip. James, is this anything other than a demotion?
Number 10 are stressing that it's not. They are saying he's going to be attending the 8:30 and the 4 o'clock in Downing Street. He's going to be on every cabinet subcommittee. They are saying that with the general election only 10 months away, they want Gove in number 10 all the time. They want this big political brain at the centre. They're also trying to say that there's no slowing down on the education reform agenda. I personally would find that a lot more credible if Gove's junior minister, Liz Truss, had simply moved up to become education secretary.
Because they're very much alike,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, but they are basically on exactly the same page, on rigour, on the importance of maths and all these things. Instead, we've got Nicky Morgan coming in from the Treasury with no previous demonstrated interest in education policy to become education secretary, and Liz Truss going off to do the environment brief in cabinet. Now, I think this adds to the suspicion that they've decided that the reform agenda, the ideological elements of it, that do upset some teachers undoubtedly, they've just become too difficult. So they've decided to park that between now and the election in 10 months' time. One of the ironies is, one of the things that is cited of things that Michael Gove has said as education secretary that have upset David Cameron is when he said that it was preposterous how many Oldertonians there were in government. I sadly feel that by moving him as education secretary, they've made it much more likely that in 30 years' time, the Tory party will still, and all political parties, will still be arguing about how many privately educated people there are in the government, because this was the man who was doing more for state education, more to drive up standards, a man who was prepared to sacrifice his own political career for that, and he's now gone from the Department of Education. I mean, that's a very sad day.
So you think then that this actually will make immeasurable, in fact, what you're saying, quite profound difference to the education reform
agenda?
Yes,
I don't think that Nicky Morgan is going to go in there and dilute it, but what I think you're going to see is that Michael Gove was constantly had his you know, the pedal to the metal. You know, he drove
and his department
on.
Were basically again him as well.
Yeah, exactly. He drove on and was prepared to kind of to basically just push on past the reform. I think Nicky Morgan is just not going to do that. Now, I think that lots of people are saying that she's a kind of Jeremy Hunt, in the same way that Jeremy Hunt took over the health department after the Andrew Nancy reforms and kind of tried to kind of mollify everyone, and that she'll act as a kind of parent's champion in the way that Hunt has acted as a patient's champion. I do think it would be much more reassuring if kind of Liz Truss was there to kind of keep the Gove agenda going.
Isabel, does it seem as if the government then is almost giving up on its own reform agenda and has decided that year five is going to be about presentation rather than action?
I think that's definitely the case, not just with Gove leaving education, but also if you look at Nick Bowles, who was installed as planning minister.
He was making progress, wasn't he?
Well, he was making progress in the debate, and he was very good at articulating why the Conservatives should again become the party of house building. But he was associated with some of the more toxic and flawed planning reforms and has just basically been ditched.
He has gone on to a bigger job at education. I mean,
I think it's still a sign that actually that they don't think that keeping him in planning, even though he does have expertise from policy exchange in education, keeping him at planning, they don't think was a safe thing to do. And I think that's one of the things that's happened at this reshuffle, is they're trying to neutralise things. Now, I have a little bit more sympathy with the Nicky Morgan argument in that she is a completely fresh face who can present the education reforms in what Number 10 clearly perceives as a non-toxic way.
Do you think Number 10 is beginning to feel that the teachers' unions have got a point and that Gove, maybe they might argue that sure, you needed to confront to get things done, but right now, when you're a lightning rod for teachers' affection and the opinion polls show that even the average parent, it thinks there's something confrontational going on here, the Gove was a bit too Thatcher-esque.
I suspect that might have been the case, because I think Labour was starting to feel that they had a bit of currency in arguing that the education big tent was somehow falling apart, that they could set up their own separate tent because Gove was so aggressive. If you look at figures like Lord Adonis, who used to obviously be very keen to praise Michael Gove, but who are less so nowadays, that there's a sense actually that perhaps Michael Gove, for all his amazing ideological drive and for his desire to improve education so that people who can't afford to send their kids to private school still get the choice that private school parents do, actually maybe it's good to have somebody else selling those achievements in the run-up to the general election. I don't know, it depends whether you think that spin or substance are more important in the next few months.
And James, what about assuaging the Lib Dems? I mean, do you think, I imagine Nick Clegg will go to bed tonight a happier man knowing that Michael Gove is not in education anymore.
But I don't think Nick Clegg will go to bed that much happier a man, because he doesn't like Philip Hammond at all. Philip Hammond is now Foreign Secretary with his very Eurosceptic leanings, which is going to concern Nick Clegg. The defence of the Gove move from those who are very close to him is this, is frankly, nothing else matters for the next 10 months apart from winning the general election. The best way to entrench the education reforms is for the Tories to win in 2015. They argue, having Michael at the centre, doing a bit of mollifying of teachers, if that makes it more likely, that's a price well worth paying. I think the point in a way, though, is that Cameron is taking a gamble here, because he's basically saying, right, I'm going to risk what I've done, what I've achieved so far, on trying to win the next election. And if I do, then we can do more. But if I lose, I already would have begun the retreat that will make it that much easier for Labour to dismantle my reforms.
Now, this is being billed as the great day of men out, women in. That is, the choreography is quite clear. I mean, last night was the night of the long knives if you were a middle-aged man. And today you've got this procession of women smiling as they go into Downing Street. Isabel, what's your reading of this? Do you think that this has been a giant leap forward for women in government? Or?
Well, I think Number 10 obviously want to present it as a clearing out of the men and ushering in of the women, almost like sort of jazz hands, here come the women, basically. But actually, if you look at who's been appointed, so the new Foreign Secretary is definitely a man. Michael Fallon has been promoted to Defence Secretary. He's quite manly too. Stephen Crabb has replaced David Jones as Welsh Secretary. David Jones was sacked partly because he was a middle-aged man. And Stephen Crabb's a little bit younger, but he's definitely got quite a big beard, so he's still a man. So actually, it's not this great advance for women. There are women being promoted, and I'm not going to complain about women doing well in their careers, but some of them have shot up through the party very, very quickly. So Nicky Morgan was a backbencher in 2010, is now Education Secretary, which is still quite impressive. So there has been an advance of women, but it hasn't been quite the kind of women domination of the cabinet that we might have been led to believe.
I mean, Nicky Morgan demonstrates that the quickest way to get ahead in this government is to get into George Osborne's good books.
Oh, of course. She's one of George's angels, isn't she?
She went to the Treasury, and she's now became one of his ministers, impressed him, became Minister for Women when Maria Miller went, and has now joined the Cabinet as Secretary of State for Education. One of the things I'm surprised by, I don't mean that the rise of women...
It sounds like a woman being helicoptered in above our heads, even as we speak, no doubt.
One of the things I'm quite surprised by is that the promotions for women haven't quite justified some of the hype and some of the headlines. So we've not seen, David Cameron has not taken the opportunity to appoint the first ever female Defence Secretary. We've seen, what, I think, three women join the full cabinet in Liz Truss going to Environment, Tina Stowell becoming Leader of the Lords, and Nicky Morgan at Education. None of these are kind of groundbreaking roles. And Esther McVeigh, who everyone was tipping for Ken Clark's old job, she has just kept her Minister of State job for employment with the right to attend cabinet, which is really not that much of a change.
So in other words, they want to say that she's been promoted to the cabinet when in fact she's doing what she's always doing.
But I think what's very odd about that was there seemed to be a logic to putting her in the Ken Clark job, which is she has a very marginal seat, and freeing her up from departmental responsibilities whilst allowing her to tour the broadcast studios and do all that stuff, that seemed to make a lot of sense. So I'm slightly surprised that they have decided to keep her in a departmental job, especially in a department of DWP, which is quite a lot of work.
I also get the impression they've slightly winched back from their reshuffle for the women from the weekend. Mm. One of the few briefings that they did give to the Sunday papers was that there would be a Tory First Lady. That was one of the stories that appeared in The Sun. Now, there's no, as far as I'm aware, no Tory First Lady, no special...
Well, other than Sam Cameron, eh?
Other than Sam Cameron. She hasn't been promoted yet.
Not yet. It's only 2 o'clock. So, James, do you not think, I mean, there was something rather old school in describing this in gender terms? I mean, we at The Spectator, well, staff here are two-thirds women, right? We didn't go out to hire people because of their gender. We just want the best. But there, it seems as if your gender is hugely important, and it almost seems as if they see the gender first and the person second.
I think what has changed with the 2010 intake of Tory MPs is that there are lots of women in there who deserve to be there on merit. I think if you look back at some of the people who previously got into Tory cabinets, you could tell that there was a concern about gender balance. Would Cheryl Gillan necessarily have been Welsh Secretary if she had been the male MP?
Theresa Villiers?
Yeah, indeed. And there were actually one female Tory who has been promoted in this reshuffle. She said to me recently that she thought that it would actually be quite a good sign if Theresa Villiers or one of the other women who are perceived to have underperformed would have left in this reshuffle, because it would have sent out a message that this was actually about merit. It would actually have made things easier for the women who are rising up the ranks, because it would have sent a clear message that actually if women don't perform, they're bound by exactly the same rules as men, and they get the old heave-ho too.
Isabel, do you think voters care about gender balance? I mean, you know, the idea is the party wants to look like the rest of the country and be modern, etc. I mean, has this been proven to get you more votes?
I don't think we're going to see a post-reshuffle polling bounce amongst women or anything like that, but I suppose what it does do is very subtly give the impression, as voters watch TV over the next few months before the election, that there are women in government. And I suppose one of the things that swing voters base their decision in the polling station on is whether they feel the government represents them, the party they're voting for represents them. So if they get a slight inkling that it's not just blokes from the home counties, then perhaps that will shift their opinion slightly.
I mean, if you look at the four ministers for the broadcast studios that I can toss up at the moment, they all do slightly different things.
We've got four ministers for the broadcast studios,
yeah,
do we?
No. So I think we've got William Hague when someone needs to come out in a serious voice.
And a Northern accent.
Exactly, and we've got a Northern accent. I imagine that he's...
It's good, equal opportunity
typecasting
him.
He will be
here,
deployed,
yeah?
if any Tory MP has a kind of Nadine Dorris moment and talks about posh boys who don't know the price of milk. William Hague will be
so he's our tribune of the working class
and the north, and also the kind of statesman, kind of, you know, David Cameron's doing things in the long term interests of the country. Then you've got Grant Shapps as the kind of the enthusiastic Tory party cheerleader. And then you've got Michael Gove for when Downing Street just wants to shut a story down. He is chief whip, but quite unusually for chief whips, going to do a lot of media. You know, remember when Maria Miller was resigning, Michael Gove was on the way in the cab to the Today programme to defend Maria Miller, and then it turned out Maria Miller resigned before he got to the studio, so he did an interview.
He's completely unruffled by
yeah,
the whole
exactly.
of that.
And he is, I think, one of the other things that they like about him is they think that Michael Gove, because he's a kind of former hack himself and because he's so articulate and makes news, their theory is that you can basically, when you're in trouble, you can call the Today programme up and says, we've just booked Gove in a cab, he'll be at Broadcasting House in 20 minutes and the Today programme will clear the slot, and on he'll go. And then you have Esther McVey as the fourth minister for broadcasting, who I think is designed to be the kind of slightly surprising, the Liverpudlian woman, who again defies the kind of idea that the Tories are all a bunch of posh boys.
Right. So we were told a day ago that Esther McVey would be the minister for television, and that would be it. From what you're saying, we've now got a minister for Radio 1, Radio 2, Radio 4, and Radio 5.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's almost we're getting to kind of designated.
We don't have a Radio 3 minister yet, do we?
I mean, Michael Gove's love of Wagner could easily do the kind of minister for Radio 3. But I think you see that kind of thing, and also you look at some of the other appointments. You know, Priti Patel has gone to Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that most appeals about Priti Patel to the Tory hierarchy is that they believe that you can use her equally effectively to attack both Labour and UKIP. So I think you'll see her on the economy trying to do that. I mean, it was very interesting that when Cameron addressed 22 the other week, he basically told them that it was the economy that was going to bring UKIP, people who'd gone to UKIP, back to the Tories. I think we're going to see Priti Patel doing a lot of that kind of small business, you know, the tax cuts we have already given you, all that kind of stuff. I think will come from her a lot.
Right. So Isabel, this suggests then that, I don't know, I mean, we journalists love to use the phrase the starting gun of the next general election, but today does seem to be a shift away from government towards electioneering with a reshuffle pretty much designed for campaigning, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you're looking for ministers who have particular policy expertise, it's quite difficult to find a lot of them who've been appointed, but they're good at selling policies, they're good at defending policies that might be unpopular. So actually they're gearing up, as James says, for that broadcast tour. It's not going to be about kind of policy wonkery over the next few months. It's going to be about trying to beat Ed Miliband and doing it in the most effective, cutthroat way possible.
But can we physically take 12 months of electioneering? I don't know.
I think if you like talking about policy, probably not. But
I think one of the other things you see is the centre is strengthened. If you think about these meetings that they have in Downing Street all the time, you're now going to have Osborne in them, Hague in them, Gove in them, Cameron in them.
Cameron, in other words, he's got a higher quality comfort blanket.
Yeah, and he's basically saying that we need political brains at the centre, people to kind of roam across government. You know, I think one of the things, though, which is potentially problematic is Michael Gove still going to be on all these cabinet committees? He's still going to be doing, he's going to have a lot more time to do right rounds. And one of the things that got on Theresa May's nerves was this sense that Michael Gove was putting his nose into her department's business.
Yes. Now he's got a license to interfere.
He has a kind of prime ministerial license to interfere, which I think could lead to some quite interesting confrontations. I think one of the other things about this is it's a complete change in the nature of the role of chief whip. Because the chief whip in kind of you know
when Michael Dobbs' books, when the chief whip was the backroom boy.
When Andrew Mitchell was appointed, the last time Cameron did a kind of big reshuffle to the chief whip job, much was made of the fact that his nickname at school had been Frasher, and that, you know, the idea was you wouldn't want to cross Andrew Mitchell. Michael Gove is okay. He has a temper that you sometimes see, but he's incredibly polite normally.
Yes, he wasn't a bully at school.
He kind of guilt trips people, doesn't he? Yeah. Doing things rather than
at school, he was bullied. Actually, there was a group of kids who called themselves the Gove Busters who went around trying to beat him up, the pooey guy. So he's the opposite to Andrew Mitchell. He's a charmer rather than a thrasher.
I suppose that the flip side to him being very good at defending the government when things have gone wrong on the Today programme or something like that is he also does, as you say, like to make forays into any policy area. And that's got into trouble in the past. And putting him in a more broadcast-focused role is useful but also dangerous, because you could see him intervening on the Second World War as well as the First World War.
He loves to go off piste, doesn't he? And tell you about the Battle of the Somme and all hell can break loose.
I think the thing about Michael Gove is he's probably... I think one of the other things about this is that cabinet is going to become a lot duller because of this reshuffle. Because if you look at lots of people who've gone, you know, Ken Clark always used to speak up and speak his mind about things. Paterson always used to speak up and speak his mind about things. So I think that, you know, I think there'll be all the more importance on the Gove interventions to kind of keep cabinet lively and entertaining.
Now, if you do go past all this and look beyond the genders, even beyond the television presentation, there is one firm result of this reshuffle, and that it does seem as if the government has taken a slightly more Eurosceptic nature. We've said goodbye to Ken Clark, the last great Tory Europhile. We've said goodbye to Dominic Grieve, who a lawyer who was devoted his maiden speech to the Convention of Human Rights because he liked it so much. And we've seen hello to Philip Hammond, who is more Eurosceptic than William Hague. He's now a Foreign Secretary. So do you think that perhaps, I don't know whether it's intended or unintended consequence of this reshuffle, but we now have a far more Eurosceptic government.
Well, I think the ECHR thing is definitely intended. It was always known that one of the blocks to Cameron doing anything about the ECHR was the fact that Dominic Grieve would basically resign if Cameron suggested, for example, leaving the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights.
And when you say doing anything, just to be clear, we're talking about that the Justice Secretary, Chris Grayling, has got a Bill of Rights, which he believes will be a new thing, senior to Strasbourg, and will repatriate all of his powers. And Dominic Grieve was fighting him, now Grieve's gone.
Yeah, Grieve. So I think on the ECHR, that is very deliberate. I mean, that enables the Tories to kind of announce that they're going to kind of sort out all the inverted commas kind of human rights nonsense, all that kind of stuff, you know, the avocatadas things. They'll be able to deal with all that. I think on the Foreign Office front, I think it's slightly more unintentional. I think it was when William Hague was going, they decided on the kind of slightly minimal reshuffle was moving. The minimum hassle was caused by moving Hammond from Defence to Foreign Secretary, but he is noticeably more Eurosceptic than William Hague. And also, he has not been prepared to simply play ball with numbers 10 and 11 at various points. He said things that have really displeased them on gay marriage, for example. Although Hammond didn't actually vote against it himself, he spoke out against the fact that it was being pushed, that it was being that why was this up the agenda, then, and made clear that he didn't like that. He was also a leading voice in the National Union of Ministers, saying that, you know, he didn't want more defence cuts.
So he's more Eurosceptic than William Hague. Why?
Oh, because he has publicly said that if we can't get substantial powers back, he would be in favour of leaving the European Union.
Right, and that puts him in a minority.
They will be kind of shock in European capitals when they read what Hammond has said. I think there will be a moment of, good God. It will be another. I think the European capitals, they have a view of the British European debate which might have been accurate in the kind of mid 1990s. I think when they read about Hammond, they will realise just how far the debate here has moved. That you can be a Tory cabinet minister who talks about how they would vote to leave if substantial powers don't come back, and still be appointed Foreign Secretary, and it not even be regarded as particularly controversial.
I think this is Labour's route into the reshuffle as well. Obviously, if you're the opposition party on the day the government party reshuffles its ranks, it's very difficult to get a word in edgeways. But actually, that they've been pitching all sorts of quotes from Philip Hammond where he's talked about leaving the European Union, and it's their chance to have a line to take, which they've been developing since last night, which is that this is a lurch to the right, and a lurch towards Britain leaving the EU, and it's dangerous for Britain's position in the world, that sort of thing. Every Labour backbencher who's been tweeting today has been tweeting that line, and privately they've been given that line as well. So actually, to be fair to the Labour press machine, which has had a few negative briefings against it recently, this is a good sign for Labour, because they've got something they can talk about.
And do you think they've got a point?
Well, I think, it, as James says, it shows how far the debate has moved in the Conservative Party, and if you think that that's a bad thing, then you probably might be quite upset by Philip Hammond's appointment. If you're a Conservative backbencher, that you're probably quite relieved, because most Conservative backbenchers did feel that William Hague wasn't sufficiently robust anymore.
I think the problem with a lurch to the right argument that Labour are pushing is there have been some pretty obvious right-wing casualties of this reshuffle.
Well, Owen Paterson, incredibly hard-working environment secretary.
David Jones were probably the two most clearly right-wing members of the cabinet. Mm-hmm. They've both gone, so I think it's going to be hard to kind of persuade the hack pack that this is some great lurch to the right. I think one of the other things that's happening, though, which is very revealing about this reshuffle, is when you promote people from the 2010 intake, you tend to move, even if you ideologically balance across that intake, you are moving the party a little bit to the right, because the 2010 intake is to the right of its predecessors in the Tory party, and I think that's one of the things we're seeing.
So this is just a strange form of modernisation of the Conservative Party. Also means moving to the right and becoming more Eurosceptic?
Yeah, well, we have seen other modernisers like Greg Barker quit and say that they're standing down as MPs, and I think Greg Barker departed on his own terms, but I think he may well have concluded that there wasn't as much room for people like him who wanted the Conservative Party to hug huskies Tory party anymore.
He's far more green, isn't he? And there was a time where, at the start of the Cameron project, Greg Barker was part of it, and Cameron sounded quite environmentalist. And this is, so Greg Barker's departure might signal the de-greening of the Tories?
I think he certainly felt that after the green crap was taken out in the reshuffle, that there was a need for the Green Conservatives to mount a fight back. But the fact that he's now leaving suggests that he doesn't think that fight back is possible, or that he can do that fight back outside
of government. He's also fulfilling the kind of old Hugo Swire role, which is Cameron is sacrificing one of his friends so he can turn around to the rest of the parliamentary party and say, look, I know you've lost your chum over here, but I had to lose my chum Greg, who I've kind of, you know, I've nobly knifed for the good of party unity.